Les colloques du Collège de France.
Great. So there is a handout, but it's not necessary. So if it ran out, then you should still be able to understand what I'm talking about. So my talk is about theoretical fictions as opposed to the sort of fictions you find in novels or other kinds of entertainment. And the practice of using theories or hypotheses as convenient fictions seems to be maybe not a common part, but a well-known part of a lot of scientific inquiry, a lot of philosophical inquiry, right? If you're modeling the solar system as a bunch of Newtonian point particles with gravitational forces on each other, it's not that you temporarily believe that the Earth is very, very small or anything like that. It's a convenient fiction, right? It's something. And as I'll talk about in a minute, quite a bit of modeling might involve treating things as convenient fictions. So some models in the sciences are kind of pretty explicitly non-realistic. So if you're modeling gene spread or a trait spread in a population in biology, one standard technique is to treat the population as infinitely large so that you get all the combinations, and the percentages in the next generation depend on the... But it's not like anybody thinks there are infinitely many fireflies or infinitely many lizards or anything like that, right? This is a convenient fiction. So philosophers have got very interested in where we can usefully do this, and there are lots of arguments about various interesting philosophical topics, about whether it makes sense or is a good idea to treat them as a convenient fiction. So some people have wanted to do this about mathematics, right? Platonistic mathematics looks kind of very natural and easy to understand, but it's kind of puzzling how we could be in contact with all of these abstract objects. Well, if it's a convenient fiction that we're using to understand, say, the physical world, a bunch of questions look like they evaporate. Or some people think that if there really were genuine moral truths, they would be objective, they would have a claim on all of us, mere recognition of them would be motivational. Some people have decided regretfully that there's no such truths in the world. Okay, so what do we do with all the moral language? Do we trash it? Do we reinterpret it? Well, maybe we treat each other as kind of moral agents and sharing kind of moral commitments and so on as a convenient fiction for getting around the world. And of course, that's very controversial, but that's an example. So one interesting question and sort of a limits of fiction question is, where does this run out? Are there any limits to what we could treat as a convenient fiction? And I want to look at one sort of extreme case, or maybe the most extreme case, global fictionalism, where every one of our commitments or every one of the things that you might have thought we believed and assert, somebody treats as only being convenient fictions. And how could that be motivated? Does that project collapse under its own weight? So that sort of global fictionalism, for every commitment we treat it as a convenient fiction, what does that look like? And if it collapses, that might give us information about what other kinds of less global fictionalism might collapse. But if it makes sense in its own terms, even if it's a little undermotivated, that might show that the strategy is very flexible. So global fictionalism can initially sound like a crazy option, and I'm not a global fictionalist myself, but I want to talk a little bit about why some philosophers have felt like global fictionalism's a place they might want to end up going. So reversing the order on the handout a little bit, one way into thinking about it that some people will be familiar with is one interpretation anyway of Pironian skepticism. So this form of ancient skepticism, it's fairly uncontroversial that they thought we shouldn't take ourselves to know things or shouldn't take ourselves to be completely confident in things. But one more radical version, people, at least interpreters, have thought, some of them thought we shouldn't even believe things. We should maintain some kind of suspended attitude, and that's supposed to be good for ataxia, for sort of tranquility, right? That one, you should be a skeptic because people worry their lives away about all of this unknowable stuff. It doesn't seem to help too much if you give up knowledge and confidence if you still have really strong belief, right? If you have really strong beliefs that you're going to be be tortured in afterlife, or really strong beliefs that doing the wrong medical thing will lead you to be in a huge amount of pain. That can be distressing too, but give up those beliefs. Give up beliefs in everything. Why? Well, so Sextus Empiricus and others have a whole bunch of arguments that are supposed to, you tell me what you believe and I'll show you why that's incoherent, or you tell me what you believe and I'll show you that there's an equally strong argument in the opposite direction. There's a whole bunch of skeptical techniques to try to drive people away from their beliefs. But, and you could be a skeptic about something local like the external world or medical theory of the day or something like that, or you could just try to go global, and some Sextus Empiricus seems to want to go global about that stuff. Now, maybe that's not fictionalism, because maybe he doesn't think it's all false, but at any rate, he refrains from thinking that it's true. Well, that's the aim. And you're supposed to... You get to have some attitude that's weaker than belief. You're supposed to sort of wander around not bumping into things, because you kind of take appearances kind of at face value. That doesn't mean believe everything the appearances present, but sort of accept it, or something weaker than belief. So if the most you do about any of your commitments is just kind of accept it or do something weaker than belief, you'll end up at least a close cousin of the fictionalist. I think whether or not that's fictionalism or not, I think is a bit terminological. But you could see how skepticism, I mean, enough people get whacked over the head with skepticism when they're undergraduates, you could see how really hardcore skepticism might drive you into a, well, I'm going to try to sort of withhold on everything. Another motivation, very old motivation, is a motivation from some Buddhist schools. So again, it's particularly controversial here, and these schools lasted for thousands of years and are still around, so different thinkers think different things. So Nagarjuna, and at the beginning of the sort of first, second century CE, is arguing that everything is empty, everything is lacking, kind of self-being. And there's a huge amount of disagreement among interpreters and also among Buddhists about what that means and what it's supposed to lead to. One part of the tradition that's fairly clear is that this goes along with an idea that there are kind of so-called two truths. There's so-called conventional truth and so-called absolute truth. And the conventional truths are at best sort of misleading or murky or weird, but they're also all the familiar ones. So there are people here, there are seats, there are cities. That's all conventional truth. Now, different Buddhist schools in the Mahayana kind of tradition, or the Bodhisattva tradition, differ on exactly what's supposed to be conventional, which things are in the conventional truth basket and which things are in the absolute truth basket, or the ultimate truth, or the sort of philosophical interesting one. And one thing that's interesting about the Majjhimaka school in particular, who take themselves to be following Nagarjuna fairly closely, is the slogan is the only ultimate truth is that there's no ultimate truth. Maybe you don't want to take that entirely at face value. It might be a little incoherent. But the idea... So some people say, well, when they say everything's empty and that it's all conventional truth, this is a piece of esoteric metaphysics. They think every property is extrinsic, or they think everything grounds everything else. And there's a lot... I think some Majjhimaka thinkers did think that, and that doesn't lead you to global fictionalism, right? So there's still people in chairs and everything. It's just some metaphysical commitment you might have been tempted to make. You should make a different one. The downside of interpreting sort of everything's empty and everything's only conventional truth that way is that it doesn't obviously serve the purposes that Nagarjuna and others think it serves. So one thing that getting things right at the theoretical level is supposed to do, if you're a Buddhist, is it's supposed to help with detachment. It's supposed to help get you to the point where you don't undergo craving or you don't undergo suffering. Or you don't undergo craving or desire. Third noble truth is that the end of desire is the end of suffering, or the end of craving is the end of suffering. Somehow this everything being empty is supposed to get you to a point where you don't suffer anymore. And I don't think the path to nirvana is just through technical grounding literature, just what you decide about which things ontologically depend on which is unlikely to kind of click you out of your concerns. But if everything being empty means the claims about them are kind of, strictly speaking, false, all the claims you're ordinarily inclined to accept are all false, maybe that could help with detachment, right? Maybe you really care about your political projects and really care about the future of your country and really care about who won the last election. But if there are no elections and there's no countries and there's no political parties and there's no distinct people, and maybe that will no longer have such a grip on you if you properly understand it. It's like, you can see why it would make a difference anyway to what your attachments were, what you thought about whether there were such a things. Now, I'm not sure the Buddhist psychology is right. I think if I suddenly came to decide that all of my friends were illusory and none of my family ever existed, I don't think I'd feel a kind of relief of detachment myself, but maybe that's just because I'm far away from enlightenment, right? But you could see how stepping back from all of your theoretical commitments might be the sort of thing that at least some thinkers would think would be conducive towards the end of desire, the end of commitment to all of the things that hold you back from the lack of suffering. So the Majjhimaka thought everything was empty, including the Buddhist sayings and Buddhist metaphysics and Buddhist epistemology. One interpretation that some contemporary people in the analytic tradition, or influenced by the analytic tradition, have taken to that is, oh, well, global fictionalism. Every commitment you make is only, it's not getting it right, it's mistaken somehow, shown by Nagarjuna undermining the ordinary commitments we'd be inclined to make. Or another slight variation of this, so the Yogacara don't think everything's empty. They think everything that you're familiar with is empty. Distinct people, chairs, France, that's all empty. There is an ultimate reality, a non-dualistic, non-empty reality for the Yogacara. But unfortunately, it doesn't fall under any of our concepts. It doesn't fall under any of our predicates. It's not intelligible through conceptual or intellectual means, at least on one interpretation of the Yogacara. So if you're this kind of Yogacara, you might be inclined to be a global fictionalist kind of in two parts. There's all the empty stuff, and maybe that's all a projection or all an illusion or all sufficiently different from what you thought that you shouldn't believe in it anymore. And there's the ultimate thingy, but I mean, it's unintelligible and it's unspeakable about, so when I try to think about it and talk about it, the most I can do is come up with something that's kind of a convenient fiction, some kind of via negativa here. I can sort of gesture at it, but I can't say it. Some of the Yogacara thought that there was some other route to contact with this thing, right? Like doing a lot of yoga, do a lot of meditation, you could be sort of in non-conceptual contact with sort of non-duality, and that might kind of trigger enlightenment. But at least all the stuff you say and all the stuff you think, at least in the ordinary way we think, for the Yogacara, on an interpretation of Yogacara, Yogacara comes in many varieties. It's all empty in the sense that it's all illusion, it's all false. But some of it's better than others, right? You don't want to run into tables. You should still keep eating rice every so often. You shouldn't sort of go out and torture animals. But that's only conventionally true, right? That's how you should live your life, ceteris paribus, but it's not, you'll miss out on the route to detachment if you really think it's true. More contemporary options. So Hans Vaihinger was famous for two things. He was a very prominent Kantian of his day. He was one of the founders of Kantstudien. He's also very famous for a book advocating fictionalism about all sorts of things, the philosophy of as if. You should be a fictionalist about chemical atoms and physical molecules. You should be a fictionalist about God and the afterlife. You should be a fictionalist about... These are all useful things to take on board, but for various reasons, you shouldn't think it's true. You should maybe... He thought a lot of these things were incoherent or inconsistent when you unpacked them. There's a fairly radical strand of Vaihinger that I think is in there. I need to do more work to try to show this to people. Vaihinger, in some moods, so he thinks Kant was a fictionalist about a lot of Kant's specific commitments, about free will, about the transcendental self, about things in themselves, about the promise of heaven, to make sure that your self-interest and your moral, when reason tells you to be self-interested and tells you to do the right thing, that never conflicts, because luckily there's a guy who kind of punishes you if you ever act out of self-interest in a way that goes against the moral law. But there's a strand of Vaihinger where he seems to think that any judgment deploying the categories gets the world wrong. The world doesn't fit our categories. We impose them, and there's a world of appearance, which is the world as mediated by the application of the categories, but that's not the world itself. And one reason he thinks this is he thinks application of the categories often drops you in contradiction. You need to think about cause and effect to do science, according to Kant, but according to Vaihinger's Kant, if you ever apply the concept of causation, you become committed to thinking that things are in a chain of cause and effect that has no start, and everything is in a chain of cause and effect that starts in an uncaused cause. Inconsistent, Kant's dialectic gets read in lots of different ways about how Kant thinks this inconsistency is resolved. Vaihinger thinks that Kant thinks it's resolved by thinking every claim about causation is false. Were any claim about causation true, a contradiction would be true. Contradictions aren't true. Every claim about causation is false. But of course, you shouldn't stop making those claims, because you couldn't do science and you couldn't investigate the world and you couldn't boil your coffee in the morning, right? It's kind of... He's also a Kantian about psychology, so he thinks every judgment we make deploys one or more categories. So every judgment we make deploys categories. No deployment of the categories delivers a truth. What are you going to do? Well, convenient fictions is the best game in town, according to Vaihinger's Kant. I'm not saying that's the right interpretation of Kant, though Vaihinger does have more textual evidence than you'd expect. But I think it's the right interpretation of Vaihinger, at least in some moods. And so you could see why, if you're tempted by Kantianism at all, you could start going down that path and end up where Vaihinger is. Fourth example, one popular approach to modelling, so scientific modelling, though people think it happens a lot outside science as well, is a kind of approach where you've got a model description, you've got a model system that's kind of fairly accurately described by the model description, and a target system, usually it's some kind of target system, and you kind of... And on one approach to this, the model systems, by and large, are fictional objects, right? They're infinite populations of breeding animals, or they're point particles in Newtonian space, or even you might have a more accurate model, right? You might have a sort of model that works, as far as you can tell, about how a piece of wood is going to experience air resistance when you put it in a wind tunnel. But it's still a model system. It's still related to the target system, related to the say, wings on planes or even things you're sticking in wind tunnels. It's a convenient fiction. So that's a popular theory, by no means universally held theory, about what's going on with scientific modelling. Second thing that some people are tempted by, not necessarily the same people, is that once you start thinking about modelling, it starts looking like it's going to be models all the way down. So I might have a sort of point particle, Newtonian picture of the solar system, but the target system of that might be some more richer model of the solar system where I start to include more parameters and things like that. Or I might have a predator-prey interaction model where the only things that kill prey are running out of food or being eaten by predators. Right. Clearly, in some sense, not a realistic model, right? Animals die for other reasons. But maybe I'm applying that to a bunch of data that gives me a model of an ecosystem. And some people want to say, look, even when I walk down to the valley and I see this big, blooming, buzzing valley, when I think of it as an ecosystem and I apply all these concepts of predator and prey and growth and biomass, I've got a model of the valley, that the target system is the valley itself, and the thing I'm describing, thinking about, is this ecosystem, this model. Or when I'm interacting with another person, of course there's another human being standing in front of me, but the thing that I'm kind of manipulating to predict, to get my predictions, is my model of them, maybe my psychological model of them. So if you think models are kind of fictions, and you think it's modeling all the way down, you never kind of get unmediated out to the target, right? I mean, there's comparative unmediation out of the target. My current kind of visual cum somatic model of microphones and lectern and stuff is pretty realistic. It's much more realistic than a sort of blueprint sketch. But if it's models all the way down, I never kind of break out of when I try to kind of grab the lectern itself. I kind of construct a new model and use it to try to manipulate the world. Not saying that's true. I think it's kind of odd to think that, but you can see how somebody might get tempted by both of those slogans and end up with everything we're doing is operating convenient fictions. Okay, so those are some, I'm not expecting you to be convinced by any of those approaches, but hopefully some of them will ring some bells. How do we be a global fictionalist? Well, the usual way of thinking about fictionalism is that it's built on a bedrock of fact. You've got something like a base discourse which you're treating realistically. You've got some fictional principles and some bridge laws that take you from how you take the world to in fact be to what to put into the theoretical fiction. Because it shouldn't be anything goes, right? What's in the theoretical fiction should depend on what's really going on. So, for example, if you're a fictionalist about colour, if you don't think the world is full of colours, but you think that this it's a convenient fiction for us to kind of coordinate because we've got colour visual systems and they work slightly differently, but it usually doesn't matter for our coordination. You might think, well, look, in the base discourse, there's a bunch of things about how light's bouncing off stuff. Maybe there's a bunch of things about how human eyes work, bees' eyes work. If you're studying bees, you want to know about the colours of things because bees are very sensitive. As we would normally say, bees are very sensitive to colours. That's the stuff you take literally and then you treat only as a convenient fiction, the idea that things are blue or things are red or this is true green or this is true green in this context or this is orange under that light or whatever. Now, if you're a global fictionalist, you have to modify that. Well, on the face of it, you have to modify that because there's no kind of base discourse of unvarnished fact or even that you take to be unvarnished fact to appeal to. So how do you do this? Can you do this? And some people have argued you can't. So Laura Guerrero has a paper arguing that sort of Buddhist global fictionalism is just going to collapse because there's no kind of basis for them to kind of get the things to be conventionally true on the basis of. Here's two options, and I'd be interested to hear about more. One is a kind of Neurath-Schipp option. So Otto Neurath thought, when we're revising our views, there's nothing kind of unrevisable in our system of the world, but we can't revise it all at once, right? Whenever we're revising what we think about logic, we've got to keep a bunch of other stuff fixed. If revising stuff we think about physics, we've got to keep a bunch of other things fixed. Any given occasion, there's a bunch of stuff I'm not messing with, even though I'm taking a distanced attitude to other stuff that's kind of up for grabs, or that I might, even though I thought it before, now I'm revising it. You could have something similar where on any given occasion there's stuff I'm taking for granted, stuff I'm treating like it's literally true, but then treating something else as a convenient fiction. So when I'm thinking about colour, okay, not really, the world isn't really coloured, but there are shapes and light and stuff like that. And then Nagarjuna or Sextus Empiricus or somebody like that makes me really worried about shapes and physical surfaces, so I'm like, okay, I'll back off that. And maybe I back off in different ways and sometimes, right? Maybe sometimes I back off to there are experiences I'm having and I'm going to work out what to treat as a convenient fiction about the objects in front of me on the basis of those experiences. Or something Rich Woodward suggested to me, sometimes you might want to sort of back off to a mathematical model. Well, here's my mathematically specified model of the room and its arrangements. I'll take that seriously for a bit and sort of suspend on the the physical objects kind of filling the roles in my mathematical model. But then you ask me about math, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's a convenient fiction. Let me read some stuff from Hartree Field to you, right? So that might be one way to at least dispositionally be a global fictionalist. Each of my commitments, you put that on the table, I'm willing to be fictionalist about it. Even if I can't do to all of them at once, even if I have to sort of always take something for granted. So a more ambitious strategy would be to think that I don't ever have to take something as true and taken for granted as true when being a global fictionalist. Now, for some steps of this process, that might be easy enough, right? Somebody asks me about quantum mechanical phenomena, and I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's a convenient fiction, but I do believe in the measurements that I'm getting in my lab. And then you say, well, you know, this physical world outside your senses, are you really sure, evil demons? And I'm like, oh, okay, okay. Seems to me like the numbers on the screen are going this way. It's a convenient fiction that there's a lab full of stuff in front of me. Experience, psychology, that's all even more up for grabs than the stuff about physics, isn't it? Oh, well, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to back off this stuff about my self-description, psychological self-description. But you might worry that's got to stop somewhere. I mean, maybe if I was the kind of being that could hold infinitely many theories in my head at once, I could just have a bottomless series. But in fact, I don't have that kind of bandwidth, so what am I going to do? Well, one option is to try to take a leaf from the ancient skeptics. So one way of reading the ancient skeptics is when other people believe on the basis of perception, the skeptic, what the skeptic's supposed to do anyway, is only accept, right? So anybody else standing here would believe there's a lectern here right now, but as a well-trained Pironian skeptic, I only accept that there's a lectern in front of me. Or as a well-trained, enlightened Madhyamaka sage, I treat as conventionally true that there's a lectern in front of me. Of course, I wouldn't make the foolish mistake of believing that there's a lectern in front of me. That would be back in the world of attachment. Of course, I'm not like that. So the other way, more ambitious way of trying to change traditional fictionalism is to say, look, the base discourse doesn't need to be something that's believed or taken to be true. There's some weaker attitude we can take, like acceptance, or this is conventional, or this is, right, gets a thumbs up weaker than belief. Now, interesting psychological question, is there a thumbs up weaker than belief? If you're into theoretical fictions at all, you probably do think there is somewhere, because that's the attitude you're having, the thing that you're taking to be fictions towards. Sorry, that was a tangled sentence, but hopefully you see what I mean. Try to have that on the inputs, right? Try to set yourself up. I mean, I can get into this mood briefly, right? Sort of make me worried enough about visual hallucination, and maybe I don't straightforwardly believe there's a lectern in front of me anymore, right? Maybe I just kind of, if I were going to believe something on the basis of what I'm seeing, I'd believe there are people in lectern, but, you know. Not saying it's easy, but you could worry yourself out of perceptual belief, perhaps. Okay, so why would you? So some motives for global fictionalism are the ones I've talked about, sort of specific arguments from specific traditions that are supposed to lead you down that path or up that mountain. But you've got some general things to point to that other people could point to as well. If parsimony is an advantage, well, have I got a parsimonious theory for you, right? It's got nothing in it, no beliefs. You've never been committed to too much, right? I tend to think that shows that parsimony has to be traded off against other things, right? So going for maximal parsimony, even if it's possible, you're missing out on something. But it's parsimonious. One thing Vaihinger was very worried about, and maybe Nagarjuna on some readings, is consistency. If you think your theoretical commitments are kind of a mess and they're implicitly committed to inconsistencies all over the place, well, if you can suspend on those or treat them as convenient fictions, I mean, you have to be able to operate inconsistent fictions, but hopefully everybody's getting pretty good at doing that the more we think about literary fiction. But at least you don't have to be fully committed to any inconsistency, right? So if you did think causation's inconsistent, then maybe you should stop thinking things cause other things. I mean, actually, causation seems so basic to me, I think I would rather think that there were the world contained true contradictions about causation. But I can at least see the pressure to just sort of back off the causation stuff. Maybe not for practical use, what else are we going to use, but for theoretical commitment. Finally, a traditional approach to epistemology has been about avoiding error, right? So don't have unjustified beliefs, don't take yourself to know when you really don't. And there's always an option for making yourself epistemologically safer, which is commit to less. And the Peronian skeptics may have done this an overdrive, but you could see why some people who think that you shouldn't try to grab the world directly rather than through models, sometimes it's a kind of skepticism that you can get it absolutely right, as opposed to right enough in a model so that it's associated with what's really going on. If you're worried enough about the risk of error, then no beliefs, no error. At least that should be the promise. Okay, so what are the problems? I'm almost out of time, thank goodness. So let me focus on what seems to me the crucial problem. Is it self-refuting? So it depends a little bit on what self-refuting is. So global fictionalism says, for the person who's the global fictionalist, they say, I'm a global fictionalist and all my commitments are false. Is that including global fictionalism? Well, it better. So you said your own view's false. Right, you lose. I think a more interesting approach to, because of course they're going to say, yeah, I told you, they're all false. It's a convenient fiction. I don't believe global fictionalism either. I treat it as a convenient fiction. One approach might be sort of consider from the outside. So I'm a realist about all sorts of things. A global fictionalist comes along and says, I don't believe anything. I treat everything, all of my commitments as a convenient fiction. Are they sort of incoherent by my lights? I mean, they reject a lot of things I accept. And I ask them, sort of, is global fictionalism true? And they say, of course not. What do you take me for? I'm a global fictionalist. Or they say, well, it depends. I can say that, but then I can also say, but it's really useful. Don't treat realism as your convenient fiction, or don't treat something else as your convenient fiction, expressivism or something. No. Global fictionalism is the approach to go for. Treat everything insofar as you can as at best a convenient fiction, and accept some things, reject others, but that acceptance and rejection isn't kind of truth and falsehood. Kind of related to that, one other worry I wanted to mention. A lot of people are going to think this is incoherent because they like excluded middle, right? Once you say something's false, aren't you on the hook for thinking its negation's true? So if the global fictionalist comes in and says it's false that there are other people, so you think there are no people. No. Oh, well, never mind what you think. You said it's false that there are people, so that commits you to there being no people. I think the global fictionalist kind of has to treat excluded middle as at best a global fiction. So some of them are more explicitly on the hook for this anyway. So one of the Kantian categories is negation. So when you form a negated judgment according to Kant, it's because you've applied the category of negation to some content that could have been an affirmative judgment. If Vaihinger thinks that every application of a category kind of rules you out of the game for getting things right, for it being true, he's got to think every negated judgment fails to be true as well. What's going on? Well, luckily, logic is only a convenient fiction, and the principles of logic, they're all false, so don't... Right. I think the Majamaka might have to think this as well. They've got to think everything's empty, including all of those negative claims. The no rhinoceros is in the room. Don't get attached to that either, right? Don't let your desire to be away from the rhinoceroses drag you into the world of suffering. Detach on that one too, right? That's not... Yeah, so I think they have to think, look, falsehoods having true negations is at best a convenient fiction and it doesn't reflect what's really going on. So I think you have to, I mean, maybe unsurprisingly, if you're going to be a global fictionalist, you have to be revisionary about a lot of stuff. And I suspect you have to do a fair bit of chopping and changing because you have to kind of say these things and then take them back when somebody says, hey, really, is that what's really going on? I think you often have to be in the mood of saying, look, I told you these things, but I have to warn you, it's just a convenient fiction. So I might leave it there and hear what you think. Can we be global fictionalists? And even if we could there be any good motivation for doing so?
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.